You'd think different if you looked at it from a boat. The cliff won't take the weight. A squirrel can make it up, but that's all. How high is it? Avery asked. 43 feet over there, almost 50 here. The kudzu vines just make it worse. The damn stuff's nearly impossible to kill, but if you try grabbing onto it, you're in for a big surprise. Like I said, if you want to check it out, do it from a boat, Ryan said. We'll do that, Avery replied. Coming in, that driveway must be 300 yards, Keaton said. Just over 400, counting the curves. It cost an arm and a leg to pave it. What about the swimming pool, people? It was Longley this time. The pool's supposed to be finished next Wednesday. Avery and Keaton walked around the north side of the house. There were trees 20 yards from there, and a swarm of brambles that went on forever. Ryan had planted a long row of shrubs to mark the border. Sally didn't go in there, either. This looks pretty secure, Avery said. There's 200 yards of open space between the road and the trees, then more open ground between the pool and the house. Right. Ryan chuckled. You can set up your heavy machine guns in the tree line and put the mortars over by the pool. Dr. Ryan, we are quite serious about this, Longley pointed out.
I'm sure. But it's an unannounced trip, right? They can't...
Jack stopped short. He didn't like the look on their faces. Avery said, we always assume that the other side knows what we're up to.
Oh. Is that all of it? Or is there more? He knew it wouldn't do any good to ask.
Well, speaking as a has-been Marine, I wouldn't want to hit this place cold. I know a little about how you guys are trained. I wouldn't want to mess with you.
We try, Avery assured him, still looking around.
The way the driveway came through the trees, he could use his communications van to block vehicles out entirely. He reminded himself that there would be 10 people from his agency, 6 Brits, a liaison guy from the bureau, and probably 2 or 3 state police for traffic control on the road. Each of his men would have both a service revolver and a submachine gun. They practiced at least once a week. Avery still was not happy, not with the possibility of an armed terrorist group running around loose. But all the airports were being watched, all the local police forces alerted. There was only one road in here. The surrounding terrain would be difficult even for a platoon of soldiers to penetrate without making all kinds of noise, and as nasty as terrorists were, they'd never fought a set-piece battle. This wasn't London, and the potential targets weren't driving blithely about with a single armed guard.
Thank you, Dr. Ryan. We will check the cliff out from the waterside. If you see a Coast Guard cutter, that'll be us.
You know how to get to the station at Thomas Point? You take Forest Drive east to Arundel on the Bay and hang a right. You can't miss it.
Thanks. We'll do that.
The real estate agent came out of the office just before 10. It was his turn to shut down. In his briefcase was an envelope for the bank's night depository and some contracts he'd go over the next morning before going into work. He set the case on the seat beside him and started the car. 2 headlights pulled right in behind him.
"Can I talk to you?" a voice called in the darkness.
The agent turned to see a shape coming toward him.
"I'm afraid we're closed. The office opens at..."
He saw that he was looking at a gun.
"I want your money, man. Just be cool, and everything'll be okay," the gunman said.
There was no sense terrifying the man. He might do something crazy, and he might get lucky.
"I don't have any..."
"The briefcase and the wallet. Slow and easy, and you'll be home in 30 minutes. The man got his wallet first. It took 3 attempts to loose the button on his hip pocket, and his hands were quivering as he handed it over. The briefcase came next.
"It's just checks. No cash."
"That's what they all say. Lie down on the seat and count to 100. Don't stick your head up till you finish, and everything'll be just fine. Out loud, so's I can hear you. Let's see. The heart's right about there."
He reached his gun hand inside the open window. The man got to 7.
When it went off, the sound of the silenced automatic was further muffled by being inside the car. The body jerked a few times, but not enough to require a second round. The gunman opened the door and wound up the window, then killed the engine and the lights before going back to his car. He pulled back onto the road and drove at the legal limit. 10 minutes later, the empty briefcase and wallet were tossed into a shopping center dumpster. He got back onto the highway and drove in the opposite direction. It was dangerous to hold on to the gun, but that had to be disposed of more carefully. The gunman drove the car back to where it belonged. The family that owned it was on vacation and walked 2 blocks to get his own. Alex was right, as always, the gunman thought. If you plan everything, think it all out, and most important, don't leave any evidence behind, you can kill all the people you want. Oh, he remembered. One more thing. You don't talk about it. Hi, Ernie, Jack said quietly. The dog showed up as a dark spot on the light-colored carpet in the living room. It was 4 in the morning. Ernie had heard a noise and come out of Sally's room to see what it was. One thing about dogs, they never slept the way people did. Ernie looked at him for several minutes, his tail gyrating back and forth until he got a scratch between his ears. Then he moved off, back to Sally's room. It was amazing, Jack thought. The dog had entirely supplanted A.G. Bear. He found it hard to believe that anything could do that. They're coming back, aren't they? He asked the night. Jack rose off the leather couch and walked to the windows. It was a clear night. Out on the Chesapeake Bay, he could see the running lights of ships plying their way to or from the port of Baltimore, and the more ornate displays of tug-barge combinations that plodded along more slowly. He didn't know how he could have been so slow on the uptake. Perhaps because the activity at Camp 18 almost tracked with the pattern that he'd tried repeatedly to discern. It was about the right time for them to show up for refresher training. But it was equally likely that they were planning something big. Like maybe right here. Jesus. You were too close to the problem, Jack, he whispered. It was public knowledge. Had been for a couple of weeks that they were coming over. And the ULA had already demonstrated its ability to operate in America, he remembered. And we're bringing known targets into our home. Real smart, Jack. In retrospect, it was amazing enough. They'd accepted the backward invitation without the first thought. And even when the security people had been here the previous day, he'd made jokes. You asshole. He thought over the security provisions, taking himself back again to his time in the Corps. As an abstract battle problem, his house was a tough objective. You couldn't do anything from the east. The cliff was a more dangerous obstacle than a minefield. North and south, the woods were so thick and tangled that even the most skilled commando types would be hard-pressed to come through without making a horrendous racket. And they sure as hell couldn't practice that kind of skill in a barren, treeless desert. So they had to come from the west. How many people did Avery say? Well, he didn't say, but I got the impression of about 20. 20 security people, armed and trained. He remembered the days from the basic officer's course at Quantico, and the nights. 22 years old, invincible and immortal, drinking beer at local bars. There'd been one night at a place called the Command Post, the one with a picture of Patton on the wall, when he'd started talking to a couple of instructors from the FBI Academy, just south of the Marine base. They were every bit as proud as his brother Marines. They never bothered to say, "We are the best." They simply assumed that everyone knew it. Just like us. The next day he'd accepted the invitation to shoot on their range and settle a gentlemanly wager. It had cost him $10 to learn that one of them was the chief firearms instructor. God, I wonder if Breckinridge could beat him. The Secret Service wouldn't be very different, given their mission. Would you want to tangle with them? Hell no. If I assume that the ULA is as smart as it seems to be, and it is an unaccounted trip, a private sort of thing. They won't know to come here, and even if they did, if they're too smart to take this one on, it should be safe, shouldn't it? But that was a word whose meaning was forever changed. Safe. It was something no longer real. Jack walked around the fireplace into the house's bedroom wing. Sally was sleeping, with Ernie curled up on the foot of the bed. His head came up when Jack entered the room, as if to say, "Yes?" His little girl was lying there, at peace, dreaming a child's dreams, while her father contemplated the nightmare that still hovered over his family, the one he'd allowed himself to forget for a few hours. He straightened the covers and patted the dog on the head before leaving the room. Jack wondered how public figures did it. They lived with the nightmare all the time. He remembered congratulating the prince for not letting such a threat dominate his life. "Well done, old boy. That'll show them. Be a fearless target." "It was a very different thing when you were yourself the target," Ryan admitted to the knight. "When your family was the target. You put on the brave face and followed your instructions, and wondered if every car on the street could hold a man with a machine gun who was bent on making your death into a very special political statement. You could keep your mind off it during the day when you had work to do. But at night, when the mind wanders and dreams begin..." The dualism was incredible. You couldn't dwell on it, but neither could you allow yourself to forget it. You couldn't let your life be dominated by fear, but you couldn't ever lapse into a feeling of security. A sense of fatalism would have helped, but Ryan was a man who had always deemed himself the master of his fate. He would not admit that anything else could be true. He wanted to lash out, if not at them, then at destiny. But both were as far beyond his reach as the ships whose lights passed miles from his windows. The safety of his family had almost been assured. "We came so close," he cried silently to the night. They'd almost done it. They'd almost won that one battle, and they had helped others win another. He could fight back, and he knew that he could do it best by working at that desk in Langley, by joining the team full-time. He would not be the master of his fate, but at least he could play a part. He had played a part. It had been important enough, if only an accident, to Francoise Theroux, that pretty malignant thing now dead. And so the decision was made. The people with guns would play their part, and the man behind the desk would play his. Jack would miss the academy, miss the eager young kids, but that was the price he'd have to pay for getting back into the game. Jack got a drink of water before going back to bed. Plebe summer started on schedule. Jack watched with impassive sympathy as the recently graduated high school seniors were introduced to the rigors of military life. The process was consciously aimed at weeding out the weak as early as possible, and so it was largely in the hands of upperclassmen who had only recently been through the same thing. The new youngsters were at the debatable mercy of the older ones, running around with their closely cropped hair to the double-time cadence of students only 2 years their senior. "Morning, Jack." Robbie came over to watch with him from the parking lot. "You know, Rob, Boston College was never like this."
"If you think this is a plebe summer," Jackson snorted, "you should have seen what it was like when I was here."
"I bet they've been saying that for 100 years, Jack suggested.
"Probably so."
The white-clad plebes passed like a herd of buffalo, all gasping for air on the hot, humid morning.
"We kept better formations, though."
"The first day?"
"The first few days were a blur," Jackson admitted.
"Packing up?"
Jackson nodded. "Most of the gear's already in boxes. I have to get my relief settled in."
"Me too."
"You're leaving?"
Robbie was surprised. "I told Admiral Greer that I wanted in."
"Admiral?" "Oh, the guy at CIA.
You're going to do it, huh?"
"How did the department take it?"
I think you can say that they managed to restrain their tears. The boss isn't real happy about all the time I missed this year. So it looks like we're both having a going-away dinner.
Geez, it's this Friday, isn't it?
Yeah. Can you show up about 8:15?
You got it.
You said not dressy, right?
That's right. Jack smiled. Gotcha.
The RAF VC-10 aircraft touched down at Andrews Air Force Base at 8 in the evening and taxied to the same terminal used by Air Force One. The reporters noted that security was very tight, with what looked to be a full company of air police in view, plus the plainclothes Secret Service agents. They told themselves that security at this particular part of the base was always strict. The plane came to a halt at exactly the right place, and the stairs were rolled to the forward door, which opened after a moment. At the foot of the stairs waited the ambassador and officials from the State Department. Inside the aircraft, security men made a final check out the windows. Finally, His Highness appeared in the doorway, joined by his young wife, waving to the distant spectators and descending the stairs gingerly despite legs that were stiff from the flight. At the bottom, a number of military officers from two nations saluted, and the State Department protocol officer curtsied. This would earn her a reprimand from the Washington Post's Arbiter of Manners in the morning edition. The 6-year-old granddaughter of the base commander presented Her Highness with a dozen yellow roses. Strobes flashed, and both royal personages smiled dutifully at the cameras while they took the time to say something pleasant to everyone in the receiving line. The prince shared a joke with a naval officer who had once commanded him, and the princess said something about the oppressive, muggy weather that had persisted into the evening. The ambassador's wife pointed out that the climate here was such that Washington, D.C. had once been considered a hazardous duty station. The malarial mosquitoes were long gone, but the climate hadn't changed very much. Fortunately, everyone had air conditioning. Reporters noted the color, style, and cut of the princess's outfit, especially her daring new hat. She stood with the poise of a professional model while her husband looked as casual as a Texas cowboy, as incongruous as that might have seemed, one hand in his pocket and a relaxed grin on his face. The Americans who'd never met the couple before found him wonderfully easygoing, and of course every man there had long since fallen in love with the princess, along with most of the Western world. The security people saw none of this. They all had their backs to the scene, their eyes scanning the crowd, their faces stamped into the same serious expression, while each with various degrees of emphasis thought, "Please God, not while I'm on duty." Everyone had a radio earpiece constantly providing information that their brains monitored while their eyes were otherwise occupied. Finally, they moved to the embassy's Rolls-Royce, and the motorcade formed up. Andrews had a number of gates, and the one they took had been decided upon only an hour before. The route into town was its own traffic jam of marked and unmarked cars. Two additional Rolls-Royce automobiles of exactly the same model and color were dispersed through the procession, each with a lead and chase car, and a helicopter was overhead. If anyone had taken the time to count the firearms present, the total would have been nearly 100. The arrival had been timed to allow swift passage through Washington, and 25 minutes later the motorcade got to the British Embassy. A few minutes after that, their highnesses were safely in the building, and for the moment the responsibility of someone else. Most of the local security people dispersed, heading back to their homes or stations, but 10 men and women stayed around the building, most invisibly hidden in cars and vans, while a few extra uniformed police walked the perimeter.
"America," O'Donnell said, "the land of opportunity."
The television news coverage came on at 11 and had tape of the arrival.
"What do you suppose they're doing now?" Miller asked.
"Working on their jet lag, I imagine," his chief observed.
"Getting a good night's sleep."
"So, already here?"
"Yes. The safe house is all prepared for tomorrow. Alex and his people are ready, and I've gone over the changes in the plan."
"They are from Alex, too?"
"Yes. And if I hear one more bit of advice from that arrogant bastard—"
"He is one of our revolutionary brethren," O'Donnell noted with a smile.
but I know what you mean.
Where's Mike?
Belfast. He'll run phase two.
The timing is all set?
Yes. Both brigade commanders and the whole army council. We should be able to get them all.
O'Donnell finally revealed his plan in toto. McKinney's penetration agents either worked closely with all of the senior PIRA people or knew those who did. On command from O'Donnell, they would assassinate them all, completely removing the Provisional's military leadership. There would be no one left to run the organization, except one man whose masterstroke mission would catapult him back to respectability with rank-and-file provost. With his hostages, he'd get the release of all the men behind the wire, even if it meant mailing the Prince of Wales to Buckingham Palace one cubic centimeter at a time. O'Donnell was certain of this. For all the brave, pious talk in Whitehall, it was centuries since an English king had faced death, and the idea of martyrdom sat better with revolutionaries than with those in power. Public pressure would see to that. They would have to negotiate to save the life of the heir to the throne. The scope of this operation would enliven the movement, and Kevin Joseph O'Donnell would lead a revolution reborn in boldness and blood.
Changing of the guard, Jack, Marty observed. He too had packed up his things. A security officer would check the box before he left. How are you feeling?
Better. But you can get tired of watching daytime TV.
Taken all your pills? Ryan asked. I'll never forget again, Mom, was the answer.
I see there's nothing new on our friends.
Yeah.
They dropped back into that black hole they live in. The FBI is worried that they're over here, of course, but there hasn't even been a hint of it. Of course, whenever anybody's felt secure dealing with these bastards, they've gotten bit on the ass. Still, about the only outfit that isn't on alert is the Delta Force. All kinds of assets are standing by. If they're over here and they show anybody a whisker, the whole world is going to come crashing in on them. Call in the whole world. We used to say that in Vietnam.
Cantor grunted.
I'll be in Monday and Tuesday. You don't have to say goodbye yet. Have a good weekend.
You too. Ryan walked out, with a new security pass hanging around his neck and his jacket draped over his shoulder. It was hot outside, and his rabbit didn't have air conditioning. The drive home along Route 50 was complicated by all the people heading to Ocean City for the weekend. Anything to get away from the heat that had covered the area like an evil spell for 2 weeks. They were in for a surprise, Jack thought. A cold front was supposed to come through.
Howard County Police, the desk sergeant said. Can I help you?
This is 911, right?
It was a male voice.
Yes, sir. What seems to be the problem?
Hey, my wife said I shouldn't get involved, you know, but...
Can you give me your name and phone number, please?
No way. Look, this house, down the street, there's people there with guns, you know? Machine guns.
Say that again?
The sergeant's eyes narrowed.
Machine guns. No shit, I saw an M60 machine gun, like in the army. You know, 30 caliber, feeds off a belt, heavy bitch to pack along, a real friggin' machine gun. I saw some other stuff, too.
Where?
The voice became rapid.
1116 Green Cottage Lane. There's maybe... I mean, I saw four of them. One black and three white. They were unloading the guns from a van. It was 3 in the morning. I had to get up and take a leak, and I looked out the bathroom window, you know? The garage door was open, and the light was on, and when they passed the gun across, it was in the light, like, and I could see it was a 60. Hey, I used to carry one in the army, you know? Anyway, that's it, man. You want to do something about it, that's your lookout.
The line clicked off. The sergeant called his captain at once.
What is it?
The sergeant handed over his notes.
Machine gun? M60?
He said it was. He said it was a 30 caliber that feeds off a belt. That's the M60.
That alert we got from the FBI, Captain.
Yeah.
The station commander had visions of promotion dangling before his eyes, but also visions of his men in a pitched battle where the perpetrators had better weapons. "Get a car out there. Tell them to keep out of sight and take no action. I'm going to request a SWAT call-up and get hold of the feds." Less than a minute later, a police car was heading to the area. The responding officer was a 6-year veteran of the county police who very much wanted to be a 7-year veteran. It took him almost 10 minutes to reach the scene. He parked his car a block away, behind a large shrub, and was able to watch the house without exposing himself as a police officer. The shotgun that usually hung under the dashboard was in his sweating hands now, with a double-aught buck round chambered. Another car was 4 minutes behind his, and 2 more officers joined him. Then the whole world really did seem to arrive. First a patrol sergeant, then a lieutenant, then 2 captains, and finally, 2 agents from the FBI's Baltimore office. The officer who had first responded was now one of the Indians in a tribe top-heavy with chiefs. The FBI special agent in charge for the Baltimore office set up a radio link with the Washington headquarters, but left the operation in the hands of the local police. The county police had its own SWAT team, like most local forces did, and they quickly went to work. The first order of business was to evacuate the people from the area's homes. To everyone's relief, they were able to do that from the rear in every case. The people removed from their homes were immediately interviewed. Yes, they had seen people in that house. Yes, they were mostly white, but there had been at least 1 black person. No, they hadn't seen any guns. In fact, they hardly saw the people at all. 1 lady thought they had a van, but if so, it was usually kept in the garage. The interviews went on while the SWAT team moved in. The neighborhood houses were all of the same style and design, and the men made a quick check through one to establish its layout. Another set up a scope-sighted rifle in the house directly across the street and used his sight to examine the target home's windows. The SWAT team might have waited, but the longer they did that, the greater was the risk of alerting their quarry. They moved in slowly and carefully, skillfully using cover and concealment until they were within 50 feet of the target house. Anxious, sharp eyes scanned the windows for movement and saw none. Could they all be asleep? The team leader went in first, sprinting across the yard and stopping under a window. He held up a stick-on microphone and attached it to the corner of the window, listening to an earpiece for a sign of occupancy. The second in command watched the man's head cock almost comically to one side, then he spoke into a radio that all his team members could hear. "The TV's on. No conversation. Something else. Can't make it out." He motioned for his team to approach, 1 at a time, while he crouched under the window, gun at the ready. 3 minutes later, the team was ready. "Team leader," the radio crackled. "This is Lieutenant Haber. We have a young man here who says a van went tearing out of that house about 4:45. That's about the time the police radio call went out." The team leader waved acknowledgement and treated the message as something that mattered not a bit. The team executed a forced entry maneuver. 2 simultaneous shotgun blasts blew the hinges off the windowless side door, and it hadn't even hit the floor before the team leader was through the opening, training his gun around the kitchen. Nothing. They proceeded through the house in movements that looked like a kind of evil ballet. The entire exercise was over in a minute. The radio message went out. "The building is secure." The team leader emerged on the front porch, his shotgun pointed at the floor, and pulled off his black mask before he waved the others in. His hands moved back and forth across his chest in the universal wave-off signal. The lieutenant and the senior FBI agent ran across the street as he wiped the sweat away from his eyes. "Well? You're gonna love it," the team leader said. "Come on." The living room had a small screen color TV on, sitting on a table. The floor was covered with wrappers from McDonald's, and the kitchen sink held what looked like 50 neatly stacked paper cups. The master bedroom, it was a few square feet larger than the other two, was the armory. Sure enough, there was an American M60 machine gun with 2 250-round ammo boxes, along with a dozen AK-47 assault rifles, 3 of them stripped down for cleaning, and a bolt-action rifle with a telescopic sight. On the oaken dresser, however, was a scanner radio. Its indicator lights skipped on and off. 1 of them was on the frequency of the Howard County Police. Unlike the FBI, the local police did not use secure, that is, scrambled, radio circuits. The FBI agent walked out to his vehicle and got Bill Shaw on the radio.
So they monitored the police call and split, Shaw said after a couple of minutes.
Looks like it. The locals have a description of the van out. At least they bugged out so fast that they had to leave a bunch of weapons behind. Maybe they're spooked. Anything new coming in at your end?
Negative. Shaw was in the FBI's Emergency Command Center, room 5005 of the J. Edgar Hoover building. He knew of the French attempt to hit their training camp. Twice now they've escaped by sheer luck.
Okay, I'll get talking to the state police forces. The forensic people are on the way. Stay put and coordinate with the locals.
Right. Out.
The security people were already setting up. Discreetly, he saw, their cars were by the pool, which had been filled up only a couple of days before, and there was a van which evidently contained special communications gear. Jack counted 8 people in the open, 2 of them with Uzis. Avery was waiting for him when he pulled into the carport.
Good news for a change.
Well, good and bad.
How so? Ryan asked.
Somebody phoned the cops and said he saw some people with guns. They rolled on it real quick. The suspects split. They were monitoring the police radio, but we captured a bunch of guns. Looks like our friends had a safe house set up. Unfortunately for them, it didn't quite work out. We may have them on the run. We know what kind of car they're using, and the local cops have this area completely sealed off, and we're sweeping the whole state. The governor has even authorized the use of helicopters from the National Guard to help with the search.
Where were they?
Howard County, a little community south of Columbia. We missed them by a whole 5 minutes, but we have them moving and out in the open. Just a matter of time.
I hope the cops are careful, Ryan said.
Yes, sir.
Any problems here?
No, everything's going just fine. Your guests should be here about 7:45.
What's for dinner? Avery asked.
Well, I picked up some fresh white corn on the way home. You passed the place coming in. Steaks on the grill, baked potatoes, and Kathy's spinach salad. We'll give 'em some good, basic American food.
Jack opened the hatch on the rabbit and pulled out a bag of freshly picked corn. Avery grinned.
You're making me hungry. I got a caterer coming in at 6:30. Cold cuts and rolls. I'm not going to let you guys work all that time without food, okay?
Ryan insisted. You can't stay alert if you're hungry.
We'll see. Thanks.
My dad was a cop.
By the way, I tried the lights around the pool, but they don't work.
I know. The electricity's been acting up the last couple of days. The power company says they have a new transformer up and it needs work. Something like that. Ryan shrugged. Evidently it damaged the breaker on the pool line, but so far nothing's gone bad in the house. You weren't planning to go swimming, were you?
No, we wanted to use one of the plugs here, but it's out too.
Sorry.
Well, I have some stuff to do.
Avery watched him leave and went over his own deployment plans one last time. A pair of state police cars would be a few 100 yards down the road to stop and check anyone coming back here. The bulk of his men would be covering the road. 2 would watch each side of the clearing. The woods looked too inhospitable to penetrate, but they'd watch them anyway. This was called Team 1. The second team would consist of 6 men. There would be 3 people in the house, 3 more, one of them a communicator in the radio van, in the trees by the pool. The speed trap was well known to the locals. Every weekend a car or two was set up on this stretch of Interstate 70. There had even been something about it in the local paper. But people from out of state didn't read that, of course. The trooper had his car just behind a small crest, which allowed cars heading up to Pennsylvania to fly by, right past his radar gun before they knew it. The pickings were so good that he never bothered chasing after anyone who did under 65, and at least twice a night he nailed people for doing over 80. Be on the lookout for a black van, make and year unknown, the all-points call had said a few minutes before. The trooper estimated that there were at least 5,000 such vans in the state of Maryland, and they'd all be on the road on a Friday night. Somebody else would have to worry about that. Approach with extreme caution. His patrol car rocked like a boat crossing a wake as a vehicle zoomed past. The radar gun readout said 83. Business. The trooper dropped his car into gear and started moving after it before he saw that it was a black van. Approach with extreme caution. They didn't give a tag number.
Hagerstown, this is 11. I am following a van, black in color, that I clocked at 83. I am westbound on I-70, about 3 miles east of exit 35.
11, get the tag number, but do not. Repeat, do not attempt to apprehend. Get the number, back off, and stay in visual contact. We'll get some backup for you.
Roger. Moving in now.
Damn.
He floored his accelerator and watched his speedometer go to 90. The van had slowed a little, it seemed. He was now 200 yards back. His eyes squinted. He could see the plate, but not the number. He closed the distance more slowly now. At 50 yards, he could make out the plate. It was a handicap one. The trooper lifted his radio microphone to call in the tag numbers when the rear doors flew open.
It all hit him in a moment. This was how Larry Fontana got it. He slammed on his brakes and tried to turn the wheel, but the microphone cable got caught on his arm.
The police officer cringed and slid down behind the dashboard as the car slowed, and then he saw the flash, a sun-white tongue of flame that reached directly at him. As soon as he understood what that was, he heard the impacting rounds. One of his tires blew, and his radiator exploded, sending a shower of steam and water into the air. More rounds walked up the hood into the right side of the car, and the trooper dived under the steering wheel while the car bounced up and down on the flattened tire. Then the noise stopped. The state police officer stuck his head up and saw the van was 100 yards away, accelerating up the hill. He tried to make a call on the radio, but it didn't work. He discovered soon after that 2 bullets had blasted through the car's battery, now leaking acid on the pavement. He stood there for several minutes, wondering why he was alive, before another police car arrived. The trooper was shaking badly enough that he had to hold the microphone in both hands.
Hagerstown, the bastard machine-gunned my car. It's a Ford van, looks like an 84, handicap tag Nancy 2291, last seen westbound on I-70 east of exit 35.
Were you hit?
Negative, but the car's beat to shit. They used a goddamn machine gun on me.
That really got things rolling. The FBI was again notified, and every available state police helicopter converged on the Hagerstown area. For the first time, the choppers held men with automatic weapons. In Annapolis, the governor wondered if he should use National Guard units. An infantry company was put on alert. It was already engaged in its weekend drill, but for the moment, he limited the guard's active involvement to helicopter support of the state police. The hunt was on in the central Maryland hill country. Warnings went out over commercial radio and TV stations for people to be on the alert. The president was spending the weekend in the country, and that was another major complication. Marines at nearby Camp David and a few other highly secret defense installations tucked away in the rolling hills hung up their usual dress blues and pistol belts. They substituted M16 rifles and camouflage greens. Chapter 25. Rendezvous. They arrived exactly on time. A pair of state police cars remained on the road, and 3 more loaded with security people accompanied the rolls up the driveway to the Ryan house. The chauffeur, one of the security force, pulled right to the front and jumped out to open the passenger door. His Highness came out first and helped his wife. The security people were already swarming all over the place. The leader of the British contingent conferred with Avery, and the detail dispersed to their predetermined stations. As Jack came down the steps to greet his guests, he had the feeling that his home had been subjected to an armed invasion.
"Welcome to Peregrine Cliff."
"Hello, Jack."
The prince took his hand.
"You're looking splendid."
"You too, sir."
He turned to the princess, whom he'd never actually met.
"Your Highness, this is a great pleasure."
"And for us, Dr. Ryan."
He led them into the house.
"How's your trip been so far?"
"Awfully hot," the prince answered. "Is it always like this in the summer?"
"We've had 2 pretty bad weeks," Jack answered.
The temperature had hit 95 a few hours earlier. They say that's going to change by tomorrow. It isn't supposed to go much past 80 for the next few days. This did not get an enthusiastic response. Kathy was waiting inside with Sally. The weather was especially hard on her this close to delivery. She shook hands, but Sally remembered how to curtsy from England and performed a beautiful one, accompanied by a giggle.
"Are you quite all right?"
Her Highness asked Kathy.
"Fine, except for the heat. Thank God for air conditioning."
"Can we show you around?" Jack led the party into the living dining room.
"The view is marvelous," the prince observed.
"Okay, the first thing is, nobody wears a coat in my house," Ryan pronounced. "I think you call this planter's rig over in England?"
"Excellent idea," said the prince.
Jack took his jacket and hung it in the foyer closet next to his old marine parka, then got rid of his own. By this time, Kathy had everyone seated. Sally perched next to her mother, her feet high off the floor as she tried to keep her dress down on her knees. Kathy found it almost impossible to sit comfortably.
"How much longer?" the princess asked.
8 days. "Of course, with number two, that means any time."
"I shall find that out myself in 7 more months."
"Really? Congratulations." Both women beamed. "Way to go, sir," Ryan observed.
"Thank you, Jack. How have you been?"
"I suppose you know the work I'm doing."
"Yes, I heard last night from one of our security people. I've been told that you located and identified a terrorist camp that has since been neutralized," the prince said quietly.
Ryan nodded discreetly. "I'm afraid that I'm not able to discuss that."
"Understood. And how has your little girl done after?"
"Sally?" Jack turned. "How's my little girl?"
"I'm a big girl," she replied forcefully.
"What do you think?"
"I think you've been damned lucky."
"I'd settle for a little bit more."
"I presume you've heard." "Yes."
He paused.
"I hope your chaps are careful."
Jack voiced agreement, then rose as he heard a car pull up. He opened the door to see Robbie and Sissy Jackson getting out of the pilot's Corvette. The Secret Service's communications van moved to block the driveway behind them. Robbie stormed up the steps.
"What gives? Who's here? The president?"
Kathy must have warned them, Jack saw. Sissy was dressed in a simple but very nice blue dress, and Robbie had a tie on. Too bad.
"Come on in and join the party," Jack said with a nasty grin.
Robbie looked at the two men by the pool, their jackets unbuttoned, and gave Jack a puzzled look, but followed. As they came around the brick fireplace, the pilot's eyes went wide.
"Commander Jackson, I presume."
His Highness rose.
"Jack,"
Robbie whispered,
"I'm going to kill you."
Louder.
"How do you do, sir? This is my wife, Cecilia."
As usually happened, the people immediately split into male and female groups.
"I understand you're a naval aviator."
"Yes, sir. I'm going back to a fleet squadron now. I fly the F-14.
Robbie struggled to keep his voice under control. He was successful, mostly.
"Yes, the Tomcat. I've flown the Phantom. Have you?"
"I have 120 hours in them, sir. My squadron transitioned into 14s a few months after I joined up. I was just getting the Phantom figured out when they took him away.
Sir, aren't you a naval officer also?"
"Yes, Commander, I have the rank of Captain," His Highness answered.
"Thank you. Now I know what to call you, Captain,"
Robbie said with visible relief.
"That's okay, isn't it?"
"Of course.
You know, it does get rather tiresome when people act so awkwardly around one. This friend of yours here actually read me off some months ago."
Robbie smiled finally.
"You know Marines, sir. Long on mouth and short on brains."
Jack realized that it was going to be that kind of night.
"Can I get anyone something to drink?"
"I gotta fly tomorrow, Jack," Robbie answered.
He checked his watch.
"I'm under the 12-hour rule.
You really take that so seriously?
The prince asked.
You bet you do, Captain, when the bird costs 30 or 40 mil. If you break one, booze better not be the reason. I've been through that once.
Oh? What happened?
An engine blew when I put her in burner. I tried to get back, but I lost hydraulic pressure 5 miles from the boat and had to punch out. That's twice I've ejected, and that's by God enough.
Oh? This question got Robbie started on how his test pilot days at Pax River had ended.
There I was, at 10,000.
Jack went into the kitchen to get everyone some iced tea. He found two security types, an American and a Brit.
Everything okay? Ryan asked.
Yeah. It looks like our friends got spotted near Hagerstown. They blasted a state police car and split. The trooper's okay. They missed this one. Anyway, they were last seen heading west.
The Secret Service agent seemed very pleased by that. Jack looked outside to see another one standing on the outside deck.
You sure it's them?
It was a van, and it had handicap tags.
They usually fall into patterns, the agent explained.
Sooner or later it catches up with them. The area's been sealed off. We'll get them.
Good. Jack lifted a tray of glasses. By the time he got back, Robbie was discussing some aspect of flying with the prince. He could tell since it involved elaborate hand movements.
So if you fire the Phoenix inside that radius, he just can't evade it. The missile can pull more G's than any pilot can,
Jackson concluded.
Ah, yes. The same thing with the Sparrow, isn't it?
Right, Captain, but the radius is smaller.
Robbie's eyes really lit up.
Have you ever been up in a Tomcat?
No, I wish I could.
For crying out loud, that's no big deal. Hell, we take civilians up all the time. I mean, it has to be cleared and all that, but we've even had Hollywood actors up. Getting you a hop ought to be a snap. I mean, it's not like you're a security risk, is it?
Robbie laughed and grabbed a glass of tea.
Thanks, Jack.
Captain, if you've got the time, I've got the bird.
I'd love to be there.
We do have a little free time.
Then let's do it, Jackson said.
I see you two are getting along.
Indeed, the prince replied. I've wanted to meet an F-14 pilot for years. Now, you say that telescopic camera arrangement is really effective.
Yes, sir. It's not that big a deal. It's a 10-power lens on a dinky little TV camera. You can identify your target 50 miles out, and it's Phoenix time. If you play it right, you can splash the guy before he knows you're in the same county. And that's the idea, isn't it?
So, you try to avoid the dogfight?
ACM, you mean?
Air combat maneuvering, Jack,
Robbie explained to the ignorant bystander.
That'll change when we get the new engines, Captain, but yeah, the farther away you can take him, the better, right? Sometimes you have to get wrapped up in the furball, but if you do that, you're giving away your biggest advantage. Our mission is to engage the other guy as far from the boat as we can. That's why we call it the outer air battle.
It would have been rather useful at the Falklands, His Highness observed.
That's right. If you engage the enemy over your own decks, he's already won the biggest part of the battle. We want to start scoring 300 miles out and hammer their butts all the way in. If your navy'd had a full-size carrier, that useless little war never would have happened.
Excuse me, sir. That wasn't your fault.
Can I show you around the house?
Jack asked. It always seemed to happen. You worked to have one of your guests meet another, and all of a sudden you were cut out of the conversation.
How old is it, Jack?
We moved in a few months before Sally was born.
The woodwork is marvelous.
Is that the library down there?
Yes, sir.
The way the house was laid out, you could look down from the living room into the library. The master bedroom was perched over it. There had been a rectangular hole in the wall, which allowed someone in there to see into the living room, but Ryan had placed a print over it. The picture was mounted on a rail and could be slid aside, Jackson noticed. The purpose of that was clear enough. Jack led them to his library next. Everyone liked that the only window was over his desk and looked out over the bay.
No servants, Jack?
No, sir. Kathy's talking about getting a nanny, but she hasn't sold me on that idea yet.
Is everyone ready for dinner?
The response was enthusiastic. The potatoes were already in the oven, and Kathy was ready to start the corn. Jack took the steaks from the refrigerator and led the menfolk outside.
"You'll like this, Captain. Jack does a mean steak."
"The secret's in the charcoal," Ryan explained. He had 6 gorgeous-looking sirloins and a hamburger for Sally.
"It helps to have good meat, too."
"I know it's too late to ask, Jack, but where do you get those?"
"One of my old stock clients has a restaurant supply business. These are Kansas City strips."
Jack transferred them to the grill with a long-handled fork. A gratifying sizzle rose to their ears. He brushed some sauce on the meat.
"The view is spectacular," His Highness observed. "It's nice to be able to watch the boats go by," Jack agreed.
"Looks a little thin now, though."
"They must be listening to the radio," Robbie observed. "There's a severe thunderstorm warning on for tonight."
"I didn't hear that."
"It's the leading edge of that cold front. They develop pretty fast over Pittsburgh. I'm going up tomorrow, like I said, and I called Pax Weather right before we left. They told me that the storms look pretty ferocious on radar. Heavy rain and gusts. Supposed to hit around 10 or so."
"Do you get many of those here?" His Highness asked.
"Sure do, Captain. We don't get tornadoes like in the Midwest, but the thunder boomers we get here will curl your hair. I was bringing a bird back from Memphis two years ago, and it was like being on a pogo stick. You just don't have control of the airplane. Those suckers can be scary. Down at Pax, they're taking all the birds they can inside the hangars, and they'll be tying the rest down tight."
"It'll be worth it to cool things off," Jack said as he turned the steaks.
"Roger that. It's just your basic thunderstorm, Captain. We get the big ones 3 or 4 times a year. It'll knock down some trees, but as long as you're not in the air or out in a small boat, it's no big deal. Down in Alabama, with this kind of storm coming across, we'd be sweating tornadoes. Now that's scary."
"You've seen one?"
"More'n one, Captain. You get those mostly in the spring down home. When I was 10 or so, I watched one come across the road, pick up a house like it was part of a Christmas garden, and drop it a quarter mile away. They're weird, though. It didn't even take the weather vane off my pappy's church. They're like that. It's something to see, all right, but you want to do it from a safe distance."
"Turbulence is the main flying hazard, then."
"Right. But the other thing is water. I know of cases where jets have ingested enough water through the intakes to snuff the engines right out."
Robbie snapped his fingers.
"All of a sudden, you're riding in a glider. Definitely not fun. So you keep away from them when you can."
"And when you can't?"
"Once, Captain, I had to land on a carrier in one, at night. That's about as close as I've come to wetting my pants since I was 2.
He even threw in a shudder.
"Your Highness, I have to thank you for getting all of this out of Robbie. I've known him for over a year, and he's never admitted to being mildly nervous up there."
Jack grinned.
"I didn't want to spoil the image," Jackson explained. "You have to put a gun to Jack's head to get him aboard a plane, and I didn't want to scare him any more than he already is."
Zing, and Robbie took the point. It helped that the deck was now in the shade, and there was a slight northerly breeze. Jack manipulated the stakes over the coals. There were a few boats out on the bay, but most of them seemed to be heading back to harbor. Jack nearly jumped out of his skin when a jet fighter screamed past the cliff. He turned in time to see the white-painted aircraft heading south.
"Robbie! What the hell is that all about? They've been doing that for 2 weeks.
Jackson watched the plane's double tail vanish in the haze.
"They're testing a new piece of gear on the F-18.
What's the big deal?"
"The noise."
Ryan flipped the stakes over. Robbie laughed.
"Aw, Jack, that's not noise. That's the sound of freedom."
"Not bad, Commander," His Highness judged.
"Well, how about the sound of dinner?" Ryan asked.
Robbie grabbed the platter, and Jack piled the meat on it. The salads were already on the table. Kathy made a superb spinach salad with homemade dressing. Jack noted that Sissy was bringing the corn and potatoes out, wearing an apron to protect her dress. He distributed the steaks and put Sally's hamburger on a roll. Next, he got their daughter in a booster seat. The one awkward thing was that nobody was drinking. He'd gotten four bottles of a choice California Red to go with the steaks, but it seemed that everyone was in a teetotaling mood. "Jack, the electricity is acting up again," his wife reported. "For a while there, I didn't think we'd get the corn finished." The Secret Service agent stood in the middle of the road, forcing the van to stop. "Yes, sir," the driver said. "What are you doing here?" The agent's coat was unbuttoned. No gun was visible, but the driver knew it was there somewhere. He counted six more men within 10 yards of the van and another four readily visible. "Hey, I just told the cop." The man gestured backward. The two state police cars were only 200 yards away. "Could you tell me, please? There's a problem with the transformer at the end of the road. I mean, you can see this is a BG&E truck, right? Could you wait here, please?" "Okay with me, man." The driver exchanged a look with the man in the right front seat. The agent returned with another. This one held a radio. "What seems to be the problem?" The driver sighed. "Third time. There's a problem with the electrical transformer at the end of the road. Have the people here been complaining about the electricity?" "Yeah," the second man, Avery, said. "I noticed, too. What gives?" The man in the right seat answered. "I'm Alex Dobbins, field engineer. We have a new experimental transformer on this line. There's a test monitor on the box, and it's been sending out some weird signals, like the box is going to fail. We're here to check it out." "Could we see some ID, please?" "Sure." Alex got out of the truck and walked around. He handed over his BG&E identification card. "What the hell's going on here?" "Can't say." Avery examined the pass and handed it back. "You have a work order?" Dobbins gave the man his clipboard. "Hey, if you want to check it out, you can call that number up top. That's the field operations office at company headquarters in Baltimore. Ask for Mr. Griffin." Avery talked into his radio, ordering his men to do just that. "Do you mind if we look at the truck?" "Be my guest," Dobbins replied. He led the two agents around. He noted also that four men were keeping a very close eye on things, and that they were widely separated, with their hands free. Others were scattered across the yard. He yanked open the sliding door and waved the two agents inside. The agents saw a mass of tools and cables and test equipment. Avery let his subordinate do the searching. "Do you have to go back there now?" "The transformer might go out, man. I could let it, but the folks in the neighborhood might be upset if the lights went off. People are like that, you know." "Do you mind if I ask who you are?" "Secret Service." Avery held up his ID. Dobbins was taken aback.
"Jeez. You mean the president's back there?"
"I can't say," Avery replied. "What's the problem with the transformer? You said it was new?" "Yeah, it's an experimental model. It uses an inert cooling agent instead of PBBs, and it has a built-in surge suppressor. That's probably the problem. It looks like the unit's temperature sensitive for some reason. We've adjusted it several times, but we can't seem to get it dialed in right. I've been on the project for a couple of months. Usually I let my people do it, but this time the boss wanted me to eyeball it myself." He shrugged. "It's my project." The other agent came out of the van and shook his head. Avery nodded. Next, the chief agent called the radio van, whose occupants had called Baltimore Gas and Electric, and confirmed what Alex had told them. "You want to send a guy to watch us?" Dobbins asked. "No, that's okay. How long will it take?" Avery asked. "Your guess is as good as mine, sir. It's probably something simple, but we haven't figured it out yet. The simple ones are the ones that kill you." "There's a storm coming in. I wouldn't want to be up on a pole in one of those," the agent observed. "Yeah, well, while we're sitting here, we're not getting much work done. Everything okay with you guys?" "Yeah, go ahead." "You really can't tell me who's in the neighborhood?" Avery smiled. "Sorry."
"Well,
I didn't vote for him anyway." Dobbins laughed. "Hold it," the second agent called. "What's the matter?"
That left front tire.
The man pointed.
God damn it, Lewis, Dobbins growled at the driver. The steel belt was showing on part of the tire.
Hey, boss, it's not